Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show with our special guest, William English. This is the members segment. William and I, Bill and I, have been having an interesting conversation because Bill was an insider in more ways than one. He was an insider as far as all the skullduggery and shenanigans of these now infamous UFO organizations from back in the day, APRO and MUFON, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to delve into a lot of hardcore stuff in this segment, Bill's time, tail end of his time in Vietnam, and then delving deeply into the contents of the Grudge 13 report, which to me is one of the most important documents ever to break the surface in the UFO field. So without any further ado, Bill English, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, Bill, just as a point of clarification, you know how stories, they get, not necessarily by the original source, but by others, they get embellished, things get added on, things get distorted. You pointed out in the first segment how you've been variously described as being in the Army, Navy, Air Force. Well, you've been in the Army, but they got you mixed up in all these other services, right? It's just been one example. One of the stories, and I'd like your confirmation whether this in fact really happened or if there was a distortion involved, had to do with the special forces team that you had brought into Cambodia. Yep. Now, according to some sources, I don't remember if it was John Lear or who, whatever the case may be, but they talked about, and I may be getting this mixed up with another similar story, but they talked about how your team had also observed aliens, for lack of a better term, collecting the mutilated body parts, putting them in containers, and then taking them to their ship. And apparently you and your team had observed this, and a firefight ensued. Could you clarify that? Because you didn't mention that in the first segment.
It never happened.
It never happened. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
It never happened.
Okay. Do you know where those stories first came from?
I have absolutely no clue. Bill Cooper, I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, yes, yes.
Bill Cooper was laying claim to a lot of what I had gone through, saying that was his experience and everything. And of course, Bill didn't like me, and I didn't like Bill one damn bit. He would take something I had said and embellish it or change it around a little bit. And of course, toward the end of Cooper's life, he had quite a following with that stupid radio show of his. And
well, he's kind of an icon these days to the so-called Truth Patriot community, because if you say anything negative about him, oh, you're a shill, you're a controlled opposition. But, you know, people have to understand that some of these people had really prickly personalities. They had a lot of things going on with them on a personal level. It made them difficult individuals to deal with, because John Lear said the same thing, that they'd come up with a code name, O.H. Krill. I'm sure you're familiar with that whole story about,
yeah.
And then later on, you know, Bill started, you know, embellishing and elaborating on that story. But anyway, getting back to your comments about Bill Cooper in this regard.
Let me tell you about Bill. I first met him at the MUFON conference. And he was seated in a great big easy chair, surrounded by, you know, people who were just hanging on every word he said. He had just married this little girl from South Korea. I suspect she was a mail order bride. He was very abusive toward her, we found out later. And she took the kids, and one dark night, and left, returned to Korea, and basically told him to stick it up his ass. Well, you know, an evening at Bill Cooper's place, the way it was described to me was sitting there with a whiskey bottle and the blinds drawn and a 45 in his lap. And his demise, whatever you may hear, I can tell you right now, he deserved everything he got. And he got it because there were some tourists who were walking around on some public land, and he came out of his house drunk on his ass with a gun in his hand, you know, threatening to shoot them and everything. They left. They called the deputy sheriffs out to tell them what was going on. The deputy sheriffs went up to his front porch, knocked on the door, asked him to come out. He came out shooting, hit one of the deputies in the head and killed them outright. And the other deputies responded by killing him.
Okay, that's key. Just hold that thought, Bill, because the spin that came out, and whether it was intentional, whether it was embellishment, because I've been around a lot of these truth or patriot types, so many of them tend to embellish stories. The story that came out later was it was a federal siege similar to Waco or Ruby Ridge, that he was gunned down by feds. But that's not the case. He was gunned down by local deputy sheriffs after he opened up on them.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
He killed one of them. And the kid he killed hadn't been on the sheriff's department a year yet. He had a wife and two kids, and he shot them dead.
So they did the only thing they could have done, because he was opening up on them, already shot down one of their mates.
Yeah. And of course, all of Bill's worshipers are going to say, well, he's a fraud and all that. Well, guess what? I've been a fraud for years.
That's right. And
so it doesn't matter anymore.
But getting back to the story, the embellishment about the securing of the B-52 crash site. Now, just to remind our listeners, the B-52 had landed largely intact.
It was like a toy plane. It had just been set down in the middle of the jungle.
Wow. Okay. And so,
there was no crash trail, none of that.
Just so the listeners can understand, as part of your duties, you would occasionally, or other similar teams would be sent out, not just trail watch and interdiction or what have you, but securing crash site, rescuing down airmen, air crews. So this is part of what you guys did. That was one of your jobs, to do this kind of a thing.
Yeah, basically. And they told us it was a crash B-52. Our job was to retrieve dog tags, any sensitive documents that hadn't been destroyed in the crash, and to destroy any sensitive equipment, avionics, what have you.
So the story that also came out about how, and see what kind of confused me also, because, need to know being what it is, it kind of confused me, because one of the stories that came out was your team was advised that the B-52 crew had sent out like a mayday stating they were being attacked by a UFO, but that never happened.
Not to us. They may have. I don't know. We didn't get that information.
That's right, because need to know being what it was, you didn't need to know that. You just had to get out there and do your job. So, okay, well, that clarifies. So there was no firefight with aliens, that you didn't stumble across a scene where there was stuffing mutilated body parts into containers and hauling it onto their craft. That didn't happen.
No.
Okay.
No, there were mutilated bodies, but we didn't see anybody getting stuffed into containers and lifted off or anything like that.
Now, were they still strapped into their seats when you found them?
Every one of them. Every one of them was strapped into their seats.
And you know how it is, because we're going to delve into this with the Sergeant Lovett aspect of the Grudge 13 report, the human mutilation apparently mentioned in the Grudge report. But a lot of the people in our field, they're familiar with the basics of cattle mutilations. One ear snipped and, the lips and the coring out of the anus and all that. So your team observed that on site, that these had been mutilated, and what you later found out were classic signs of a human mutilation.
Yeah. Well, actually, what we have since learned to be cattle mutilations.
Yes.
There wasn't a drop of blood anywhere. And usually in a jungle, when there is a dead body, it's generally covered in insects and you know, whatever parasite there happens to be in the jungle in that area. There wasn't a bug on them. There wasn't a drop of blood. There was no blood dripping on the bodies or anything like that.
All the classic signs that we've come to know later, not just from the cattle mutes, but also by the human mutes, that some of the characteristics for both species, humans and bovine, the incisions, what have you, were similar. They were basically the same MO with just different types of species.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And just to close the book on the Bill Cooper aspect, it's your considered opinion, based on his known tendency to embellish.
Yeah.
And because John Lear talked about this, the whole O.H. Krill thing, people needed to delve into that. It takes too long to get into it here, what little I remember. In your considered opinion, it's likely that it was Bill Cooper that had taken some of your story, embellished it, repackaged it, and now there's these stories going around, have been for decades now, about a firefight, about the bodies being put into containers, and none of that happened.
None of that happened.
Okay.
And, Bill Cooper is, he was an alcoholic. He had a very bad reputation among employers, would-be employers. So he basically made a living out of that shortwave radio show that he had, and his bullshit speeches.
It explains a lot.
Well, he'd given, inadvertently had given a reference with a school. So I called the school and said that he had listed them as a reference. And the HR guy, when I said Bill Cooper, he started laughing hysterically. He said, "That's tough of a bitch. Don't believe a word he says."
Well, you probably heard the recorded message that it may have been the last voicemail Bill Cooper ever left on John Lear's answering machine. If he didn't know any better, he was like threatening John, right?
He was threatening John. But what he didn't realize about John was a genuine article. John didn't have any reason to bullshit. He would take an incident. He would investigate it. He would ask questions. He would meticulously note your answers and ask if it was all right if he used it or made it public. And you said yes, he'd do it. If you said no, he wouldn't. And then move on to the next case, which in John's case was... Oh, God, my memory's going. What's his name from Area 51?
Bob Lazar.
Yeah, Bob Lazar. And one thing that Bob had said was that he had been employed at Los Alamos. Well, Los Alamos wouldn't confirm or deny it. And, in cases like that, you sort of left up in the wind. So he asked me if I could find out anything. So I drove up to Los Alamos, and Los Alamos has a museum there. And part of the museum is a little display they had entitled Los Alamos Employees in the Community. And when I went up there and took a look at that, There was a picture of Bob Lazar standing next to a drag racer because Bob had said that he, participated in local drag racing in New Mexico. And there was a picture confirming, yeah, he did participate in drag racing in New Mexico, and he was an employee at Los Alamos.
There was even write-ups. I can't remember if it was in the Los Alamos Labs newspaper or a local newspaper about how he built this hybrid jet car, this rocket jet car, where he attached some kind of big rocket engine onto the back of a Honda or something. I saw the picture of that.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, that's what the picture was. It was a picture of him and his Honda.
Just to change tack for a second, before we shift gears and talk about the contents of the Grudge 13 report, the aftermath of your time in Vietnam, where it turned out that a lot of the members of your team that you had gone with to the what you thought was going to be a typical crash site, but it wasn't. Apparently, they were led into an ambush by a person that you thought may have been a defector or some kind of a spy.
He was an American defector.
Could you go into that story? Because I don't want to get too conspiratorial. I don't want to get ahead of myself. But I just can't help but wonder if that had happened as a direct result of being part of that that search team. Like somewhere along the line, someone higher up decided to wipe the slate clean and do away with all the witnesses to that B-52 event. So could you take us through that process? Was there anything different about that briefing? Was the person who led you into it a new member on that team? How did all that play out?
Well, I'm not sure what you're asking.
I'm sorry. What I meant was that American defector, and then you got led into the ambush. Could you take us from the briefing stage of that mission to the mission itself and the aftermath? What happened?
Well, the briefing stage was very straightforward. Go in, retrieve, destroy, come out, turn everything in to MACVSOG, and go on to the next assignment. And all the participants on the team were all the participants on the team. The individual that led us into the ambush was what we thought was our point man. All we saw was his back, and we didn't get a chance to see a profile or his face. It was just, he would walk behind the bush and come out from behind the bush, and we kept following him, waiting for a sign or a signal, and we got led straight into it.
Yeah, these were NVA that were shooting at you.
Yeah. We were, six of us were shot outright, and four of us were taken captive. And of the four, I'm the only one who survived.
I take it you were taken to a camp further north, or what happened?
Yeah, we were taken to what they call the roving POW camp and kept in a tiger cage, which was basically constructed of bamboo and vines and stuff like that. And we were, tied up, and they would take one individual out and torture them. And sometimes they would torture them to death and they never came back. Other times they'd torture them and then throw them back in the cage so that we could watch them die. They did that three times. With me, they had a little extra fun. And the reason being was because I was familiar with the culture and customs of the Vietnamese. And I imitated a chimpanzee. And they thought I was crazy. And they would take me out of the cage and do all kinds of unspeakable stuff, but I never once broke character. And you got to bear in mind that at the time I weighed close to 250 pounds, and when they took the last guy out, they literally flayed him alive. They threw him back in the cage, and he had somehow managed to get a lid from a sea ration can of some kind and shove it up under the muscle that was exposed. They threw him back in the cage. He pulled it out and looked at me and said, "Get the hell out of here before they kill you too." And I used that to cut my way through the bindings on the cage and cut my guard's throat and took off a dead run. And all I remember is that there was this sound of this helicopter tracking me, and I just ran. And finally, this big, giant black fellow tackled me. He told me later that it was almost like I was trying to beat him to death or get him to kill me. But they finally got me tagged and bagged into a helicopter, and they hauled me off to the hospital in Saigon, and I was red tagged, which meant that they weren't going to send me back to the States. They were going to let me die in Vietnam and say that I died in action. Well, you got to remember, I went from 250 pounds to almost skeleton. I was, 98 pounds when they found me.
How long do you reckon you were in there for?
I was in there for about maybe 4.5 months, I think.
Oh, wow.
And I'd eat anything. That's probably what kept me going, was the fact that I didn't turn my nose up at anything I could get. I would eat cockroaches and any kind of bugs, centipedes, anything. Just, to get some calorie value. But I was in the hospital in Saigon for, I guess, almost 6 months. And what happened was is that they'd red tag me, and this little nurse would come by and ask, talk to me briefly, basically to check and see if I was still alive or if I had died. And I asked her one day, I said, "I want you to do me something." She said, "What?" "I said, why don't you go to mess hall and bring me raw meat, salt shaker, a knife and a fork, and a trash can." And said, "Okay." And next thing I know, there's a big plate of steak sitting there in front of me. And I'd saw off a piece of meat, salt it, chew it, swallow it, puke it up, and just keep doing that. And finally, it got to the point where I started keeping food down and started getting hungry. And the day I could keep a whole steak down without puking it up, I started gaining weight. And the doctors were beside themselves. They couldn't understand what was going on. But instead of that being my golden ticket home, the sons of bitches waited until I was back in health, had regained a good amount of weight, had gone into the gym and started working out and getting my strength and stuff back. And then they put me on active duty again and gave me another tour of duty in Vietnam.
Jeez, no rest for the weary. doing the same job, or they cut you some slack? Or?
Doing the same job. So, but I'll tell you what. The first thing I did was find that son of a bitch that led us into the ambush.
Had he gone over to the other side, or was he still in one of the teams?
No, he had gone over to the other side. He was never one of the teams. But they used him as bait.
Found him, huh?
I found him. You bet your ass I found him.
Wow.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to.
No, no. Oh, it's quite all right. You can cuss if you want to. And I'm sorry about the confusion earlier when I was asking the question. I was trying to frame it in such a way, and I wasn't. I just had a question in my mind whether the whole thing was a setup just to get rid of you guys. You know, I couldn't help but wonder that, because some black ops, they do things like that. Getting back to the Grudge report, Project Blue Book 13, if memory. The contents, what little I've read, what's come out in book form, I think that we talked earlier about William Steinman's book. I think that Wendell Stevens had something to do with that book as well, UFO Crash at Aztec. That's one of the first places where I came across your information. I thought the contents were astounding, quite frankly, and it fit in with other information relative to Area 51, UFO crash retrievals, etc. Could you take us through some of the findings in that? For example, there was talk about relocation centers where people that had been exposed to
abducted,
how the Air Force had set up these essentially detainment camps to take people away. And it referenced the so-called Darlington Farm case in Ohio, rural Ohio somewhere. Yeah. What more could we learn about that from your memory?
Well, memory serves me on the Darlington Farm case. What had happened was the family was sitting down at table for dinner, and they heard one of the family dogs making some really strange noises and yelping as though it had been hurt. And the son got up and went out to the front to see what was going on. And then all of a sudden he started screaming and yelling. And the father and mother had gone out to see what the hell was going on. And they saw the son and the dog, or what was left of the dog, sort of floating up in the air toward this great big silvery disc. And father had a shotgun close to the door, and he shot at the thing, and all of a sudden they fell to the ground and the thing zipped off. And the father called the local sheriff, and the local sheriff came out and took the report, looked at the dog, saw that the dog had been injured. And that the boy apparently had some injuries on him, too. And he took the report, filed it with his department and the, I don't know if it was the NCIC or whatever it was, but it went on the whatever network it was that they had at the time. And within 24 hours, according to the report, they had been taken into custody and relocated to a holding facility, which was specifically designed to incarcerate individuals. But in any case, they had just disappeared for all intents and purposes. The farm was deserted. Nobody was there, and they had been taken into custody onto this holding location. And there were mugshots within the Grudge Blue Book 13 report that showed them. wife, mother, the son, and the father.
Some of the distortions of the story that came out later was that the boy was taken away by the aliens and never seen again. And the parents were in a state of shock, as you could imagine, and they called the local sheriffs, and then eventually the military got involved. So as far as your recollection is concerned, the boy wasn't taken away, but he did suffer injuries, which was documented.
Yeah, and apparently when they were incarcerated, he was put in, under treatment for his injuries and a psych eval. In fact, all of them were put under psych eval.
And no one ever heard of the family ever since. For all intents and purposes, mm-hmm. They were.
For all intents and purposes, they disappeared forever.
From what you could understand, they'd already set this up for just this kind of contingency. They'd already had the facilities. Oh, yeah. They already had the mechanism in place.
Oh, yeah. The facilities had, from what I was able to discern, the facility had been in existence for quite some time.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, my mentor, she worked with a family, and long story short, somewhere in Indiana in the 1950s, this multi-generational family, grandparents, parents, grandkids, were at this remote farmstead, and they all got abducted by aliens. They showed up, aliens done their thing to them, and then the aliens departed, and before too long, army trucks rolled up, and they quarantined the family in-house for like 3 days, 3 or 4 days, and didn't allow anyone to come or go. They had a hazmat team out there to go over the grounds with Geiger counters, and they had the usual medical, psychological follow-up. So it just reminds me, in a way, in this case, as far as I know, the family wasn't taken away, like what you described in the Grudge Report. But the fact that they would have these facilities in place and a mechanism already set up to basically Shanghai people, so you never see hide nor hair of them again, that's deeply troubling.
Well, I'm gonna tell you right now. I'm at that age where I finally understand just how wicked governments can be, and I'm of the disposition that what I knew as a kid was not necessarily true, because when I joined the Army, I believed in John Wayne, America could do no wrong, and America was right versus might, and all of that kind of stuff. And nowadays, I know better. What we're seeing play out in the news now is just verification of just how rotten things can get.
And there's a direct tie-in, in my view, as far as the connection to the non-human controlling factor, which I feel is behind all of this, because all of these Babylonian kind of occultic, atrocious behaviors and activities, which had been sub rosa for lo these many centuries, now they're in our face constantly. These attempts to normalize all of this and the activation of the Luciferian commie left, they're being armed while the rest of Americans are being disarmed, or they're trying to. What we're seeing now is the culmination of this non-human agenda, that they're pulling out all the stops and they're working through their hybrid minions in order to do this.
Well, yeah, one of the things I find kind of interesting is the United Nations Agenda 21. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, I live in a part of New Mexico that's pretty isolated because we've got McGregor Range south of us, which is part of the Army Artillery Brigade from Fort Bliss, and part of White Sands Missile Range. The name is no longer White Sands Proving Ground. It's White Sands Missile Range. And there's a little mining town, dead center between El Paso, Texas, and Alamogordo, New Mexico, called Oro Grande. And, you know, it's sort of a one-horse town. It's got a gas station, a bar where you bring your own bottle, a post office, and several miners or old miners that have lived there for donkey's years. But on the south side of Oro Grande, which is the name of this place, there is a railroad pull-off, which suddenly appeared out of nowhere. And I guess it was about maybe June or July of 2013. There was some construction on the railroad line, and this siding where, you know, railroad cars would pull off and everything. Well, I used to collect belt buckles. And there was this gas station, you know, truck stop, that sold some of the nicest belt buckles I'd ever seen in my life. And they weren't cheap. But I'd stop there every once in a while to look and see what they had. And the siding was maybe 200 yards off. And it was new. And I walked over to it to see what it was. And what I found was on the siding in between the tracks were what appeared to be flexible gas lines with pop connectors that, you know, like you shoved up onto the fixture and it clapped on, and when you pulled down on it, you pulled down on the outside of the ring and it would pop off, that looked like gas line connectors. I guess it stayed that way for a couple of years. And then all of a sudden, we started seeing train loads of Humvees, desert camouflage vehicles of various kinds, all heading out to a track that went right directly through White Sands Missile Range to what we assume were storage areas. But I mean, they were taking vehicles out there, arms, equipment, stuff like that, and storing it out there. And to this day, as far as I know, it's still there.
Did this appear to be NATO hardware, or did it seem to be former Eastern Bloc? Because at a similar rail siding,
it was NATO hardware.
Oh, it was NATO hardware. Okay.
Yeah. You know, M60 tanks, all that kind of stuff. Now, McGregor Range, nobody can go out there because they say it's covered with unexploded ordnance and that kind of thing. And there was an incident a couple of years ago where a lady and her friend apparently got out of their car and popped over the barbed wire fence and found something, picked it up, and it exploded and killed both of them. So, you know, but I remember McGregor Range very intimately because I took basic training at Fort Bliss, and we would always get hauled out to McGregor Range to learn how to shoot, throw hand grenades, and learn how to low crawl. So I know that range by sight, taste, and feel.
So there is some kind of facility there now where they're storing a lot of this stuff.
Well, I don't know if it's on McGregor, but it is certainly on White Sands.
Okay. Now, that's interesting. We've had reports along these lines all over America, really. One time near Barstow, my buddy Craig Bowers and I were driving along over an overpass, and then he said, "Get off at the next exit." right? So at the bottom of the overpass, I get out of the exit. I take the exit and we go down. Long story short, we're at a marshalling yard, and there's a long, long flatbed of flat rail cars, about a quarter mile at least. And from
just loaded up with equipment.
Well, it was loaded up with not knowing any better. If I didn't know any better, it was Eastern Bloc at the time equipment, because they didn't look NATO-ish. They looked to me like, you know, this is a little older kind of, you know, commie
And it might well have been.
Yeah. Yeah. Just because at the time, this is in the Clinton days, you know, Bridges to America and the expansion of NATO absorbing all these former Warsaw Pact countries. So many of our National Guard units were cross-training with, you know, former Eastern Bloc nations. And as far away as the Central Asian so-called republics, Chechens and Uzbeks and Tajiks were being trained by Americans and being brought over here, right, or brought over there, rather. So this has been in the works for a long time, this prepositioning. Oh, yeah. Of technology and the housing of foreign troops under the guise of endless cross-training with American forces at numerous bases and ranges around the country. So the balloon's going to go up at some point, and something is going to happen to trigger Article 5 of the NATO Convention to justify, you know, peace enforcement, if you will.
Considering what's going on politically, wouldn't now be the right time for the aliens or whatever to make their presence known publicly?
Yes, it's interesting that now suddenly, well, limited hangout to be sure, because they're not going to be sharing your kind of information. But, you know, with these videos, the Navy pilots, the so-called Tic Tac, the redefining, redesignating them as UAPs instead of UFOs. And then even Congress comes out in the recent past and says they're of non-human origin and it's a threat to national security, something many of us have been saying for a long time. Suddenly, it's an issue again, right? And whether it's a case of the aliens themselves saying, okay, kid gloves are off, we're not going to bother concealing ourselves, you guys work for us anyway, right? And this is how we're going to roll. Yeah. Nothing you can do about it, or they, what many people talk about, a fake alien invasion. But my feeling about that is this whole paradigm is controlled by aliens, essentially. This whole non-human factor is behind, like, so much of the evil and wickedness that we take for granted these days. It cannot be of entirely human origin, the way I see it, but that's just my take, Bill.
You know, anything's possible. I used to tell people that I had never in my life seen a UFO, and I hadn't until John came out to visit me here in Alamogordo, and he asked me to drive him between Alamogordo and Tularosa, New Mexico. Now, as you're going down the road on the left-hand side of the highway, all of that is White Sands Missile Range. And he told me to pull over to the side of the road, pulled out a set of binoculars, and he started looking. And as he watched, we started seeing lights go up and down over the range. You know, forwards, backwards, up and down. And I looked at that and I said, what are you showing me, John? And he said, well, that's your first UFO. And he came out to visit me three or four times after that. And it was always the same thing. And one time we went up to Sunspot here in the Lincoln National Forest, which is the solar observatory. And the weird thing about Sunspot is that they have residents up there for, you know, families, the astronomers and stuff like that. And we drove up there and it was, I guess, about 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. There wasn't a light on in any of the houses. we actually were able to get out of the car and walk into one of the observatory areas, and we weren't challenged by anyone or anything. It was like it was nobody was there, and you know, and it wasn't long after that that Don decided that maybe his attentions were better off someplace else for the moment.
Did you ever hear any stories about an underground base there at White Sands?
Yeah. White Sands is surrounded by a mountain range, which is all granite. It's got storage facilities bored into the mountains. It's got all kinds of things that were built during the Second World War. The proving grounds were initially set up when the government came in and seized ranch land without compensating the ranchers for it. There's a big history to that, and on several different occasions, several New Mexico senators have tried to get compensation for the surviving family members, but everybody's croaked and nobody knows who to pay who anymore. So basically the government stole half of New Mexico.
Under eminent domain or something along those lines?
Yeah, basically. They claimed it as eminent domain, sealed it off, stuck Holloman Air Force Base at Alamogordo, and White Sands Proving Grounds is what it was originally called, was the headquarters for Operation Paperclip.
Yes, because they brought a bunch of the Paperclip German rocket engineers to work there, and they apparently did a lot of the testing of the V-2s there.
Yeah. Alamogordo's got quite a history with the V-2. I was a archivist for a while for the New Mexico Museum of Space History, and which was started by Dr. Stapp and several of his colleagues. Some of them were German, including Werner von Braun, and the doctor that delivered me was a German. So, you know, Alamogordo has quite a history with the Germans.
Did they reference anything about the alleged alien landing, whether the dates vary? Some people say it was 64, some others say it was 1968, but like an alien landing that was expected by the military there at Holloman Air Force Base.
1964, and the hangar is still there. I was in that hangar about 6 weeks ago for the Holloman Air Force Base air show. I fly model airplanes, radio-controlled airplanes. And my club was asked to put on a show out there. So, the hangar is still there. We were set up inside the hangar. My father was the one who told me directly about the landing of the UFO at the hangar at Holloman Air Force Base. Now, you have to remember, too, that back in those days, Holloman was a pretty remote area. I mean, it's nothing to get there now, but back in the old days, when I was a kid, it was all on a two-lane dirt road. And the hangar was where the UFO was supposed to have landed and moved into the hangar. And there was some sort of summit or meeting that took place, which lasted for several hours. The human participants left, and then the UFO very slowly, apparently glided out of the hangar into the night.
And your dad, because of his job as an engineer, he became aware of this from others he talked to who were around at the time?
Yeah. Also, Dad was in charge of tracking photography on using high-speed cameras when they did missile tests. And on several occasions, he said that they had photographed UFOs buzzing the range. And on one occasion, he said that when he was working at Cape Canaveral, the tracking cameras that they used for rocket launches went off, and they got several minutes worth of film of UFOs buzzing the Cape.
Yes, I've heard similar stories. I can't remember the guy's first name, but went by the name of Jacobs. He was in Big Sur, and he was part of a team filming a launch out of Vandenberg. And similar thing happened where this flying saucer started flying rings around the nose cone of this missile that was launched. They were filming the missile, and they didn't actually see the UFO in real time. It was only after the film was analyzed that, you know, they realized that there was this flying saucer like emitting light and doing all these funny maneuvers. Yeah. And also, if memory serves, did something like this come up in the Grudge report where they talked about missiles in flight, in test flight, being essentially abducted?
Yeah, lifted right out of the flight trajectory by a UFO.
So describe any details. Were the craft bigger than the rockets, or did they somehow, it didn't matter, you know, the size, the relative size between the two, somehow they made it disappear?
It was one description said that it was like the object just sort of snuck up behind it and slowly absorbed the missile, you know, from the edge of the saucer all the way to the nose cone of the missile.
Wow.
And on another occasion, it described it as the saucer just hitting it with a beam of light and it disappearing.
Wow. A couple other things in the time we got left, and yeah, John, I'd like to get you back. I feel so inclined because you got so much information to share. In the Sergeant Jonathan Lovett case, right there at White Sands, we've been talking about White Sands all this time. Could you take our listeners through what you had gleaned from the Grudge report about Sergeant Jonathan Lovett? What happened to him?
Well, Lovett, you have to bear in mind that. Hello, you there?
Oh, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. I heard this weird noise come out of my phone. And
oh, shoot. I just had to reconnect with Bill. He was just about to dive into the Sergeant Jonathan Lovett story, which is key to a lot of this. And just then we started hearing weird interference, and then his phone cut off. Go figure. So without any further ado, Bill, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Oh, yeah. Not a problem.
Yeah, well, you were just about to delve into the Jonathan Lovett case. Please continue.
Well, you got to remember that there were two people involved. Lovett's lieutenant and Lovett. And Lovett and his lieutenant were out trying to recover materials from a missile test that had taken place earlier that day. And they were up on the northern part of the range. And Lovett separated from his lieutenant. And they story went that when he separated from his lieutenant went to try and find him and couldn't. And he traveled all over the place in the Jeep and called for backup, and they started search teams out in that area. Now, you got to remember, White Sands is called White Sands for a reason.
Yes.
The sand is absolutely pure white. And it's very easy to get disoriented. So they had search teams out there and everything. And finally, I guess it was about 2 or 3 days later, they arrested the lieutenant because they had found Lovett's body mutilated. And there was no possible way anybody else could have done it except for his lieutenant. Yet when they apparently did an autopsy, what they found was absolutely bizarre. And there were a few autopsy photos mixed in with the report and everything. But eventually, as the story went, the charges were dropped against the lieutenant. He was re-stationed to some place, you know, in the Azores or whatever, you know, to count penguin butts and basically stay out of everybody's way. But Lovett's case was probably one of the very first documented human mutilations that took place.
Now, what did the lieutenant have to say? What was his take on it? Did he see Lovett abducted, or did he just hear him scream, or he just noticed he was missing?
Yeah, all of a sudden? Apparently he heard him screaming, and he went up over the sides of the hill expecting to see him, and he wasn't there.
Uh-huh.
And 3 days later, a search party was out in that exact same area. They went over the top of the rise, and they found Love's body.
And it had the telltale indicators of what we now come to know as a human mutilation, the drained blood, right, the cored out anus and all that?
Yeah, the whole nine yards. But the interesting thing about it was is that Lovett had gone missing 4 days prior, and the temperatures out in that area had reached anywhere between 95 to 110. So you gotta remember that anything that dies out in that kind of heat gets pretty desiccated pretty quickly.
Yes.
And apparently he was still pretty juicy.
He wasn't messed with by scavengers, coyotes, vultures, or anything?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Let me give you a fair word of warning. I'm 70 years old. My viewing of the Grudge Blue Book report was pretty close to 50 years ago. So I may not be getting everything exactly the way it was, you know, originally, you know, the way I originally told, but, you know, there are some things that do stick out.
The salient point, the mutilations were consistent with what happened with the B-52 crew and similar mutilation cases that we know of in Latin America, Brazil, and other places, because some of the researchers down there come up with similar grisly findings. In the time we've got left, and thank you so much again, Bill, for coming on, there was a reference in the Grudge report, if memory serves, and this ties in later on with the Bob Lazar story, about Project Red Light. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but was there a reference to Project Red Light in relation to test flying recovered alien space vehicles in Nevada?
Yes. What I recall is a series of photographs of what looked like disks that had been recovered and taken to Area 51, or a location in the Nevada desert, is the way it was described. It didn't give an Area 51 or anything like that, where they started trying to do reverse engineering. And on a couple of occasions, they had tried to reverse engineer it. And one of them, they had tried to fly one, and they weren't very successful at it. And the pilot died, and he apparently died from what looked like radiation poisoning.
It specifically referenced that he died of symptoms consistent with exposure to radiation.
Yeah, well, what they said was it appeared to have been the Okinawa syndrome.
Did they elaborate on that, or did they just mention it in passing?
They just mentioned it in passing.
Huh, Okinawa syndrome. Well, I wonder if that has anything to do with the, you know, atomic weapons used on Japan, even though Okinawa is an island. That's interesting.
You know, I don't know why they would call the Okinawa when it was Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
And Hiroshima, yeah, that's right. It's strange.
But it said the Okinawa syndrome. So, I, you know, for all I know, it could have been massive shark attack.
Yeah. Now, what John Lear talked about in some of the presentations he gave, where he referenced your material, and I'm sure you and he had pretty deep conversations about all this. He did mention something in the Grudge Report, which I thought was interesting. He mentioned that there were quotes or remarks attributed to Dr. Doolittle, i.e. General Jimmy Doolittle, James Doolittle, something about some of Doolittle's predictions coming to pass in reference to some of the more troubling aspects of all this, including the human mutilations. What did you infer from that?
Well, I'm kind of biased. And the reason being is that I have some familiar ties with Doolittle.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of my heroes, I'm not ashamed to say. But
please. No, I mean, I'm related by blood to Doolittle.
I actually said hello to him when he hung up on me. He was actually listed in the phone book. I called up. It was his voice. I said, "Is this General Doolittle?" He just hung up, and I understand why. I'm just being a troublesome UFO researcher, but at least I heard the old boy's voice. So please continue.
Well, he was not very well liked by the family. In fact, the family lore is that he was a real son of a bitch. But I find it interesting that he would be the head of that operation where he claimed, or the claim was made, that flying objects came out of a hole in the center of the Antarctic, or the Arctic, whichever. Christ, I can't remember at this stage of the game, but anyway, you know, they had naval ships there and everything, and they were attacked.
Is this related to so-called Operation High Jump? I forget the name of the admiral, but he went down to Antarctica, and apparently they had all these issues with flying craft.
Yeah.
And Doolittle was somehow involved in that.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know this. Please continue.
Well, apparently he was the head mucky muck and had made the decision that everybody pack their shit and get home.
Well, that's interesting. It would make a lot of sense because we know in 1946 timeframe, Doolittle was up in Sweden investigating the so-called ghost rockets, ghost ships So why wouldn't he be in the lower southern latitudes involved with high jump? The name of the admiral escapes me at the moment, but apparently it was the largest task force post-World War II. They went down there and yeah. they got their asses kicked, apparently, by these aliens or whatever.
Yeah. Got them handed to them on a silver platter. Interesting thing about it is, you know, these are little tidbits that have been lost to history. You know, I can only tell you what I remember from what I saw. And as I get older, my memory gets fuzzier. So forgive me if I don't.
I'm really appreciative of the time you've spent with me, and I would love to have another discussion with you again at a time when it suits, because I wasn't aware of this aspect of Doolittle's career. I've heard similar things that he was a real hard ass. He didn't say boo to his co-pilot on operation to fly off of the Hornet. The whole time his co-pilot sat there next to Doolittle, and Doolittle didn't even say boo to him the whole time. And here they are flying into the jaws of death, you know? So, you know, I've heard similar things about how he was pretty much a hard ass when he needed to be. Like the story goes back that when, you know, in the early days and flying those crates, you know, bound together with duct tape or whatever. And when Doolittle was an instructor, and then when a plane would crash and then the student pilot would die, Doolittle's attitude was next student. Come on, let's go. He was a hard ass. And it's interesting that you have that family connection and you've got this deep connection with the whole subject matter in general. Like I can see it coming from different angles, your father, your connection to Doolittle. One more comment I want to make before we wrap things up here, it could just take too long to get into the story. During the break, Bill shared with me the fact that Wendell Stevens, the late Wendell Stevens, was set up, essentially, was falsely accused of being a pedophile. They destroyed his career. They destroyed his reputation. It makes sense now why he recanted, why in his very last interviews he said that there were no alien bases in the Arctic Circle, that they didn't investigate out of a base in Alaska all these activities of aliens in the Arctic Circle. He recanted and said he felt it was all German technology. Now, from what Bill tells me, it's the final missing piece. I can see why he recanted the way he did, because I still believe that Wendell Stevens was there, Air Technical Intelligence Center, and monitoring the ET activity out of Alaska, et cetera, that absolutely happened. So, Bill, thank you so much for coming on to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. I can say absolutely this epic interview.
I want to thank you for contacting me. It's been a long time. And finally, you know, I can honestly say, see, I told you so. But bear in mind, too, there's something you might want to think about. All of this sudden attention to UFOs or UAPs or the Senate, the video and everything could be another misinformation gimmick.
Absolutely, I agree with that. It's at the very least, it's a limited hangout. They're trying to control the narrative. There's no doubt in my mind that that's what they're doing. There's something underhanded about it all, Bill.
Yeah. But it destroyed my life. It destroyed one family. And I paid the price for it. And I have more right than anyone else to bitch about it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Bill, for coming on. And let's stay in comms. Once again, thank you for coming on to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
My pleasure. Feel free to call me at any time or message me.
Thanks, Bill. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Because this is a frequency war.